I'm Peter Suderman, and this is The Reason Rundown, the podcast to end your week. One Reason journalist, one big story, once a week. You've probably heard of Marjorie Taylor Greene, the Republican congressional representative from the 14th District of Georgia. Greene has openly dabbled in conspiracy theories.
Q is a patriot. We know that for sure. There's possible satanic worship, and maybe that all these scary things that people talk about on what's considered conspiracy sites and conspiracy theories really may be true.
And she's often been cast as a leading example of the GOP's far-right fringe.
Not only do we have the D.C. jail, which is the D.C. gulag, but now we have Nancy Pelosi's gazpacho police spying on members of Congress.
So it's no surprise that she's inspired some challengers, not only from the Democratic Party.
Thank God for Joe Biden. She is an embarrassment to the state of Georgia.
Well, we all have our opinions.
Amen to that, and I've got mine.
This year, Angela Pence, a Georgia mother of eight and local business owner, announced that she would be challenging Greene for her House seat, and she'd be doing so as a member of the Libertarian Party. Pence wasn't a complete stranger to Libertarian politics. She'd campaigned for LP presidential candidate Joe Jorgensen in 2020, but this was her first time running for office herself.
And I went right up to her. I shook her hand. I said, I'm Angela Pence. I'm the Libertarian running against you. And like you could tell, like there was some serious shock.
Pence's case against Greene was simple. Greene was emblematic of what Pence called the Republican Party's turn toward authoritarianism. America, in her view, needs more immigration, more openness, and less government intervention into individual decisions. Greene stood in the way of all those things.
It's fun to see that conversation evolved, how involved the government is in literally every aspect of our life.
Pence would face an uphill battle against Greene under any circumstance, since Georgia's 14th congressional district is one of the most solidly Republican in the country. But there was a bigger, even more immediate problem. To truly challenge Greene, she had to get on the ballot first. And Georgia has what are arguably the strictest ballot access rules for third parties of any state in the country. That made any third-party candidacy a near impossible feat.
So you may have loved me as a candidate, but because the state of Georgia doesn't want anybody messing with the duopoly, I can't run.
It's a story that if you were actually to write this in a book, honestly, I probably would quit reading the book because it's so unbelievable.
Here to chat with me about Pence's attempt to challenge Greene and Georgia's long, strange history of ballot access restrictions is Reason reporter Eric Boehm. Boehm has written extensively about the quirks of American election law, and he recently spent time with Pence in Georgia. Eric, we should probably start by acknowledging that Pence failed to get on the ballot. She didn't make it. So tell me, what happened? What were the ballot access requirements that Pence failed to meet? Just walk us through the process here.
Yeah, that's right. Angela Pence failed to meet that deadline. They failed to meet the threshold to qualify for the ballot. The deadline was July 12th, so about a week before we're recording this. And she fell quite a bit short, but she's not alone in that because no third-party candidate has qualified for a congressional race in Georgia since the 1960s.
And the main thing to do this is you have to gather signatures, right?
That's right.
And how many signatures did she need to gather, and how many did she end up getting?
Yeah, the Georgia's ballot access laws are, as you said in the opening there, if not the toughest in the country, among the toughest in the country. You have to file what they're called petitions with the state in order to qualify for the ballot. You have to get people to sign, literally sign a document that says that this person is vouching for you as running for as an independent or a third party candidate
for
Congress. It's
not just a signature. It's some other personal information,
right?
You
have to give your phone number. You have to give your address. You have to actually sign the form twice. I watched this process play out a few times because I spent some time down there in Georgia along with Angela Pence as she went around trying to collect these signatures. And it takes time. It's not as easy as saying, hey, sign this piece of paper. First of all, you have to explain to people why you're asking in the first place, because this is not something that most normal Americans are thinking about. This is not part of the voting process as most people understand.
And people don't give away their signature for free. They're sort of primed to think, hey, this person's asking me to sign a document here. I should take that seriously, or maybe I should just not pay attention to them at all.
Right, right. I mean, you want to know what you're signing, right? If you're being asked to sign this official-looking document, it's not as easy. It's not an easy process, and I actually talked to, at one point for the article, one of the former chairmen of the Libertarian Party in Georgia, and he kind of laid out the process here. I guess we should say the number, which is the important number, is what you have to get is 23,000-ish signatures. It actually varies a bit because the qualification is 5% of the number of registered voters in the district where you are trying to run. So let's do a little math here. I don't want to do too much math on a podcast, but there are roughly 700,000 people in every congressional district in the country. That varies a little bit. Obviously, they're not all exactly the same, but around 700,000. In this particular district in Georgia, the 14th district, there are about 460,000 registered voters on the books. And so to get 5% of that total is about 23,000.
And you have to do that by a specific deadline. And that deadline has been moving up in recent years, right?
Yeah, the deadline, when they first passed the law, the deadline was, I think it was in mid-September, and now it's the middle of July. I do want to do like a little comparison here, though, just to sort of illustrate, because 23,000 abstractly maybe doesn't sound like an overwhelmingly large number. I grew up in Pennsylvania, and I first started covering politics in Pennsylvania, and I first wrote about ballot access laws in Pennsylvania. And Pennsylvania has some relatively strict ballot access laws. The rule in Pennsylvania is that you have to get signatures totaling 2% of the largest vote cast for a candidate in the district that you want to run in. That's confusing, but here's what it means in reality. It means that, let's say you hypothetically want to run in the first district in Pennsylvania. That's in the Philadelphia suburbs. Representative Brian Fitzpatrick is the guy in that district right now. In 2020, he got just a hair less than 250,000 votes. So 2% of the largest total that a candidate got in the last election is 2% of 250,000. That's roughly 5,000 signatures you would need if you want to run for Congress against Brian Fitzpatrick in Pennsylvania. And that's a relatively high threshold.
So it's
5,000.
So compared to Georgia, that Pennsylvania process that you just walked us through is a smaller percentage of a smaller number that is also a more relevant number.
Right, exactly. It's a more relevant number because it reflects not just the number of registered voters, but the number of voters who actually participated in the last election, the number of votes cast for the winning candidate. It's a function of that. But you're talking about 5,000 signatures versus 23,000 signatures. Georgia's threshold is almost five times larger than, and Pennsylvania's is, as I said, it's stricter than some. The laws are really all over the books. And in most states, there's also a separate threshold for if you want to run as a statewide candidate, like if you want to run for Senate or for governor. In Georgia, actually, it's a lot easier to qualify for the ballot to run statewide than it is to run a congressional race, which also seems backwards. And that the congressional race rules also apply to the state legislative districts. So if you want to run for state house or state senate, you have to meet that same 5% of the registered voters in your district threshold. And of course, this creates a big barrier to fixing this problem because it is very difficult for independent and third party candidates to qualify to run for state house and state senate in Georgia, which means the state house and state senate are, of course, dominated by Democrats and Republicans who have zero interest in changing this rule to allow more competition.
So let's back up just a little bit. This process seems crazy to me, but there is some history that helps explain it. And that history goes back to attempts to prevent communists, like actual capital C, capital P, Communist Party, communists, from getting on the ballot. So how did Georgia end up with these incredibly strict rules, and what does the Communist Party have to do with it?
Yeah, that's right. This was all done to stop commies from running for office back in the 1940s. There were no ballot access laws.
So you support this then, right?
Oh, I mean, no. I think let the commies run for office. We should beat them. They should be allowed to run, and they should lose every time. There was no ballot access law in Georgia at all until 1922. The first law that was passed was actually super liberal by today's standards. It actually guaranteed the right of any independent candidate to appear on the ballot without having to send in any petitions or filing fees. So it basically just codified, hey, if you want to run for office, you can run for office. That was on the rule. And we should also say, as an aside, you know, Georgia in the 1920s and 30s, not exactly like a bastion of democracy, right? Like, black people faced basically universal disenfranchisement. Women had only just recently gotten the right to vote. The Democratic Party system controlled the state. Franklin Delano Roosevelt got 86% of the vote in 1940 in the presidential election in Georgia.
So it was
a one-party state, right? It's a one-party state. You have to be a Democrat if you want to get elected anyway. So there's this very permissive ballot access regime that exists, probably in no small part because the status quo was so strongly towards just one party. That starts to fracture in the 1940s. We get sort of different political parties are forming. There's kind of more political competition happening in the country. The Communist Party of the United States was trying to get candidates on the ballot in lots of states. And in Georgia, Secretary of State John B. Wilson just unilaterally said, no, we're not going to let the communists on the ballot. And I guess he could do that, which is kind of crazy. But he did. He just single-handedly threw them off the ballot. He told the Associated Press at the time, it would be against public policy to place on our ballot the names of candidates of a party which seeks to overthrow our democratic constitutional form of government, which is really kind of funny and ironic considering that this law now protects Marjorie Taylor Greene. But that's the original justification for they kicked the commies off the ballot. The state legislature came back over the next couple of years and kind of, you know, realizing that this is not a great precedent to set where you have the Secretary of State single-handedly deciding who can be on the ballot and not or not. They came back and they passed this law that exists today, the 5% threshold, which is essentially meant to keep third parties off the ballot. Like, it is expressly meant to keep people outside of the Democratic Party, Republican Party establishment off the ballot.
So what happened at first was the Secretary of State said, no, we're going to keep communists off the ballot just by fiat. And then the state legislature was like, that seems like maybe a problem for one person to just be able to decide this. But they passed a law that just is intended to basically make it impossible for any third party to be on the ballot.
Yeah, I talked to political historian Darcy Richardson for this piece, and he told me that the primary purpose for the law is to discriminate against the Communist Party. Like, that's just clear from his reading of the primary documents. I went back and looked at some old newspaper accounts also in researching the story, and it's fascinating. Not only did Wilson first single-handedly throw the communists off, but then he proposed to the legislature, according to newspaper accounts at the time, he proposed that the legislature pass a law codifying that the Secretary of State could decide who gets on the ballot, like, by himself. He just wanted the authority to have that. The legislature thankfully didn't do that. The thing we ended up with is at least, it's a bad law, but it's at least it sets some sort of
standard. At least it's a
standard,
process,
right? At least there's a process there, yeah.
This does set up sort of an interesting conundrum. On the one hand, if it was just the Secretary of State, you might have some flexibility and you might have some secretaries of state who are like, sure, the Libertarian Party can be on the ballot. On the other hand, we now have a process that is at least clear and transparent and you can understand how it works. But that process effectively makes it impossible for third parties to get on the ballot here, right? Like, so we have a sort of like, It's bad for one person to just decide. On the other hand, the alternative to that was a process that is also bad and makes it very, very difficult, if not impossible, for third parties to run.
Yeah, and as we already talked about, obviously fixing this through the legislature is basically a non-starter because there's very little incentive for Democrats or Republicans to change this law. So really fixing it through the judicial branch is really the only way that this is going to change. There have been many attempts to do that. There have been several lawsuits over the years challenging this law. One of them is ongoing at the moment. And there was a brief moment of hope for candidates like Angela Pence last year. In March of last year, a federal judge invalidated this 5% law and then gave both parties in the lawsuit a few months to say, hey, you know, give me some proposals for how we could fix this and make the standard different. And in September, that same federal judge ruled that the 5% threshold would be lowered to 1% of the registered voters in your district. Practically what that means is instead of that 23,000-ish signature total, you would need between 4,500 and 6,500, depending on the district. There's different numbers of registered voters in every district, so the number would be a little different. But you would bring that down from the 23,000 level down to basically where Pennsylvania is, right, where a lot of other states are, in that, you know, a few thousand signatures is enough to qualify for you for the ballot. That ruling was made in September, and so it looked like candidates for this cycle would have, for the first time, kind of a real chance to qualify for the ballot in Georgia. Unfortunately, then the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals reversed that ruling in January of this year, reinstated the 5% rule, and in what I think is just a really rich reading of this law, a really rich sort of assessment of the situation, Judge Britt Grant wrote that the state had an interest in avoiding, quote, confusion, deception, and even frustration of the democratic process, end quote. And that's why you could have this law, like, that what people would be confused if there's more candidates on the ballot or something, that we would be somehow frustrating the democratic process by letting more candidates run for office, by letting voters have a greater choice, by the more democracy is going to break the democratic process, I guess, is the reasoning there. Doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I asked Angela Pence about that that ruling and that line in particular, and she told me that she thought it was total bullshit.
I want to run an analogy by you. You write a lot about trade policy and the way that tariffs are used to protect American industries, often at the expense of American consumers. It's tariffs on, say, steel or whatever are a form of protectionism. And so they cost the general public while benefiting a small constituency, say, the say American steelworkers. These ballot access laws strike me as a form of political partisan protectionism in that they do benefit Democrats and Republicans who are on the ballot at the expense of voters who want alternatives. Does that seem fair to you?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. In fact, it's even worse because when you have protectionist trade policies or you have protectionist licensing schemes or any sort of economic protectionism, the mechanism that's happened there is you've had an industry or a group of industries who hire lobbyists and make campaign donations and like go through the political process and win support and eventually pass a law. And we can sit here and say that's a bad law and that law has negative economic consequences and it hurts consumers and it hurts other businesses. We can lay it all out. But at the end of the day, like it went through the proper process, right? Like they bought the interest that they needed. They bought the influence that they needed to get that law passed. And there's at least some sort of barrier there between the special interest that wants the law and the passage of the law. In this case, the special interest that wants the law are the people passing the law. It's literally the lawmakers, the Democrats and Republicans in the state legislature in Georgia or in any state who directly benefit from this. So it's political protection. It would be as if like the steel industry could literally put its own CEOs in Congress to then vote for protectionism. There's not even the sort of multiple steps in between that. And I think if you look at this, if you leave aside, there's obvious questions of fairness that come up here because Democrats and Republicans automatically qualify. And anybody who gets at least 5% of the vote, any party who gets 5% of the vote in a congressional district automatically qualifies.
Right. Marjorie Taylor Greene did not have to go through this process. There was no signature gathering.
Right. So those the nominees of the major parties automatically get on. I should mention that there is a Democrat challenging her, too, Marcus Flowers. But this is, as you said at the beginning, one of the most overwhelmingly conservative districts and Republican districts in the country. So she's going to win re-election basically without a meaningful challenge. But if this scheme, if this whole thing is constitutional, as the 11th Circuit has said, then you have to assume that it would be equally constitutional if done in every state in the country. And if it was done in every state in the country, if we had the same set of ballot access laws everywhere, it would be reasonable then to conclude that no third party or independent candidate would have qualified for any ballot anywhere in any congressional race in the country since the 1940s or since the 1960s when this was passed. One candidate in Georgia did qualify in the 60s.
And there was another instance, I believe, in the early 1980s when the laws were briefly suspended because of some sort of legal complication. But we're gonna just sort of...
The 5% threshold didn't exist for 1 year because of some redistricting stuff that had to be done. It was temporarily suspended, right? But leaving all that aside, you could envision a scenario here in which if this law were replicated everywhere, the courts would, I guess, presumably uphold it as constitutional, and yet the outcome would be that literally nobody else would qualify for the ballot outside of the two parties. And just to put that in bigger context, every state in the country has had a third party or independent candidate on a ballot for a congressional race at some point in the last 6 years, in the last three House election cycles. There's been one in every state. Georgia hasn't had one since the 1960s. It's a clear outlier. If that alone doesn't make it unconstitutional, it at least should give, I think, courts pause to say, wait a minute, this law is clearly undermining kind of fundamental democratic principles.
So before we go, I do want to ask you about the specifics of the race. As I mentioned up top, Marjorie Taylor Greene has a reputation, I think in many ways fairly deserved, as a kind of a crank. She's an exemplar of a certain type of Republican crazy person, or at least the GOP fringe. Tell me, what has she done to earn that reputation? But also, tell me a little bit about Angela Pence. What's the choice here? Or what would the choice be if Angela Pence were on the ballot?
Yeah, Angela Pence has made the argument to me, and I watched her make this argument to people as she was out gathering signatures at a Pride event in Rome, Georgia, that I went to last month. That she wants to stand for. It's she's obviously running as a libertarian, but you kind of get the sense that she's running as an old school conservative, as a like the government shouldn't get to tell you what to do conservative. Although that's maybe unfair to her. She has also told me that she is an anarchist at heart. Like, she is, she doesn't want the government to tell anybody what to do under any circumstances. But what she has identified, and I think correctly identified, in Marjorie Taylor Greene is a sort of tendency towards authoritarianism, towards the government getting and the conservative Republican politics getting more tied up in telling individuals how they should be living their lives, trying to impose virtue from above. And she has she's quite funny and enjoyable to talk to. And she really has no time for that. Like, she will just tell you flat out what she thinks of that. And she's not a fan. And I think that's right. I think that that's the type of candidate that in this district is the type of candidate that would have to run to have a chance of unseating Marjorie Taylor Greene. Right. I mean, a Democrat can run, but this is the Cook Political Report puts this district at R plus 27. It is, you know, deeply, deeply conservative. So I think there'd be, you know, it'd be very difficult to see a Democrat make any sort of inroads there. But I think a candidate who could make the argument for sort of small government and traditional conservative values, and also kind of make the point of like, hey, Marjorie Taylor Greene is a bit of a crank who has talked about like the Jewish, you know, conspiracies and global cabals of people trying to traffic children and things like that, and who was involved, you know, pretty intimately in some of the plotting of January 6th. I think there's lots of things that you could make an argument to voters who are looking for an alternative. You could make an argument for a kind of libertarian candidate in that political space, in that part of Georgia. This is the northwest corner of the state of Georgia. So she would not win, I don't think, but at least if we didn't have this law on the books, she would at least have a chance.
There's one other detail that I just want to ask you about. I mentioned that Angela Pence, the LP candidate here, is a mom of eight. I understand she has a ninth kid on the way. She's also a small business owner, but not like a used car dealership, right? You want to tell me just a little bit about her business?
Yeah, she runs an apothecary in Chickamauga, Georgia, which is, it's not probably fair to call it a suburb of Chattanooga, Tennessee, but it's in that, you know, it's basically right on the Tennessee border up there in the northern part of the state. Yeah, she runs an apothecary shop. She's also a doula, which is effectively a birthing coach, somebody who helps a woman through the birthing process. You're not actually a doctor. You don't actually do any of the medical stuff, but you sort of make sure that the midwife or the doctor, whoever is working, is following the birth plan that a woman has put together. So she has, yeah, had eight of her own children. A ninth is on the way. She's also helped several other mothers, you know, shepherd new children into the world. And she just has like a really positive outlook on the world for a candidate who was facing this completely insane ballot access requirement. She's about as cheerful a person as you will ever meet. And is, I think, that the type of candidate that third parties need if they want to compete, like somebody who just kind of has boundless energy and optimism, despite the obvious state of politics and the obstacles that are in her way.
And because of Georgia's third party ballot access laws and the restrictions there, it means that not only is she not going to be on this ballot, it means that voters aren't really going to get to learn her name. And that, to me, is, I think, one of the sort of hidden consequences here, is that being on the ballot is a form of marketing, because so much of politics is about name recognition. And if you're not even on the ballot, then most voters will never hear your name at all, which means that, sure, Angela Pence probably would have lost to Marjorie Taylor Greene, even if she had been on the ballot this year. But because she's not on the ballot, she can't build a name for herself in Georgia politics. And that deprives Georgia voters of a choice and of information that could be useful to them going forward. So that's all the time we have this week, folks. Thank you, Eric, for talking to us here. If you want to learn more about Georgia's ballot access laws, be sure to check out Eric's article, How Georgia's Outlandish Ballot Access Law is Protecting Marjorie Taylor Greene and the Two-Party System, at Reason.com. Also, if you like this show, please remember to subscribe and recommend it to friends. As always, if you like this podcast or Reason's work generally, you can support us at Reason.com/donate. That's Reason.com/donate. I'm Peter Suderman, and this has been The Reason Rundown.